Blog Talk Radio.
I think I'm in.
Okay.
Stroll through the picture. What I've left behind. It once again. I'm locked up in memories. They all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, good evening, good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us on Stop Child Abuse Now radio show on NASCA. I'm your host tonight, Dr. Nancy, and I am honored to have our wonderful guest join us tonight. Looking forward to introducing her. Her name is Victoria Valentino. I will start just by sharing a little bit about what NASCA stands for and our mission statement. So NASCA stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. We're on scan number 3395 tonight. And if you would like to be a part of our panel tonight, please call the number. It is 646-595-2118. Again, the number to call in is 646-595-2118. Our mission statement is, we have a single purpose at NASCA: to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional trauma, and neglect. And we do so with only two goals. One, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. Two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Again, we are on scan number 3395. And I'm going to start by reading the bio for our special guest. Tonight's special guest is Victoria Valentino from California. Ms. Valentino was an acting student in New York's American Theater Wing. Born in Hollywood during WW2, she was raised in Connecticut. When she became Playboy's Miss September 1963, it radically redirected her life and career. She was a multi-race child and domestic abuse and sex trafficking survivor by the age of 21. As a struggling single mother to a racially mixed son, she became an actress, a go-go dancer, folk singer, songwriter, to many ends meet. She opened the first Playboy Club on the Sunset Strip on New Year's Eve, 1964. In 1969, on the day she was celebrating her recording contract with Capitol Records, her six-year-old son drowned in her music attorney's swimming pool in Hollywood Hills. Several weeks later, kidnapped and raped by Bill Cosby, Victoria became a registered nurse and specialized in home hospice. Ms. Valentino has been in many magazines and news articles. Today, she lives in the foothills of the San Gabriel Mountains with her dog and a big orange cat. She's a keynote speaker, sexual assault activist, and mentor to survivors of rape and sexual assault. Accepting many awards, she looks forward to more crocheting, gardening, cooking. She cooks gumbo. Spending time with her 6 grandchildren. And just maybe writing her next book. Ms. Valentino is quoted as saying, "I feel as though I'm just getting to live my real life." Everyone is invited to engage in tonight's show. Make sure you visit NASCA.org. The website is, again, NASCA.org. Or call 646-595-2118 to be a part of our live panel tonight. We would love to have you. We would love to hear from you. And we would love for you to be a part of our panel again. Without further ado, I would like to welcome our special guest, Ms. Valentino, Ms. Victoria.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me, and I'm really honored to be here. This is important work.
This is very important work. We just, again, our NASCA family would just like to thank you for always stepping up and for being a voice for the voiceless for the community and for talking about such a very sensitive topic. Many people, you know, when they've been through abuse, if you don't mind turning the background sound, I'm sorry, it's a little echoey. But a lot of people who have been through what some of the things that you mentioned here, they are not able to talk about it. They feel silenced. They feel embarrassed. They feel scared to come up and be a voice. And so it's not an easy task, and we just really want to thank you for your leadership and for being so brave and right enough.
Well, thanks for saying all of that, and it is true. It's not easy to talk about, and it took me a lot of years to be able to find my own voice. I never addressed the abuse truly with my mom and my dad, and now they're dead. But I don't think they could have and would have been able to deal with it. The little things that I said to them then, they found ways to get out of it, you know, get out of discussing it. It just wasn't something that they were willing to look at or have any kind of real discussion, any kind of sensible adult discussion about it. So none of that was ever resolved with them. And I didn't start speaking out about my experience with Bill Cosby until the end of 2014. It'll be 10 years now come November, November 22nd, in fact. And that was the moment that really started opening up the door into all of those dark places that I had been living with for all my life and never really addressing in any kind of a healthy way most of the years after all of the rapes and assaults and infringement on my personal space and my self-esteem and my integrity. I was ricocheting from one wall to the other, I think, just ping-ponging with symptoms that I now know are symptoms of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. But, of course, it hadn't been addressed or identified at that time or labeled. So when you're behaving in ways that are really unhealthy and nobody talks to you about what is really going on and has any kind of compassion or empathy or, you know, attempts at really trying to understand and help, you find yourself much more isolated and you think there is something essentially wrong with you, and you don't really understand that it's not really who you are, it's your reaction to everything that's happened to you, having no support system, no understanding. Every therapist I had been to either also put moves on me or they used me to act in their master's thesis film. So I'm sorry, you'll have to excuse. I have little old dogs here who are coughing and doing all kinds
You're
of annoying
fine.
Things. But I can't put them in the other room because otherwise then they'll bark because they just, they're little old guys who just need a lot of attention and understanding. So please bear with
okay.
with us,
yeah.
my tribe here. So anyway, you know, when you're isolated, as so many survivors are, especially child survivors, you find more aberrant behaviors because they're just bouncing off of all of the trauma and they don't even know why they're behaving the way they're doing. You know, they're angry, they're hurt, they're isolated, they're ashamed, they're damaged, and their innocence has been stolen. And they're just reacting. And they wind up being judged instead of treated, instead of understood, instead of hugged and loved and supported in so many ways that would ultimately help them along the road to healing. So finding our voices is not an easy thing to do at any age.
Exactly. You know, I appreciate what you're saying right now, what you're talking about as far as, especially when we talk about child abuse survivors, you know, because as you go into teenagehood and you may act out, even if you're still, let's say, child abuse survivors and you're a child and you're acting out, then you're a teenager and you're acting out, then you're a young adult and you're acting out, then you're an adult and you're having issues and, you know, you're acting out because you haven't, you know, healing is a lifelong journey, So you made a couple of, well, you made many good points, you know, that they become judged and not understood. And people who understand recovery, they can step back and say, okay, let me just be careful with this because I know from my personal experience, even from my own personal self, that sometimes I require a little more patience, right? And so when you, if a person on the other end doesn't understand that recovery process, they might be a little harsh, and that could be damaging to the healing process. What's your thought?
Well, yeah, more than harsh. You know, they wind up labeling you as a whore, or they label you as, I don't know, whatever names come to mind, right? And they reject you, which is the one thing that you don't need. You don't need to be pushed away. You need to be drawn in and held. You need to be held and prayed over and lifted up to the light. You need to be told it's not your fault and that you're really a good person. And also that they're sorry these things happened to you. But too often, I remember my mother saying to me, well, you know, you told me that he had put the make on you. Well, no, I never told her that because I was 15 living out in the woods in Connecticut in the 50s. I don't think I'd ever even heard that expression. And it was a friend of theirs who was staying for the weekend, you know, and I told her that he had bent me over backwards outside the kitchen when I had gone down for my little mug of milk before I went to bed and kissed me and stuck his tongue down my throat, and I pushed him off and ran upstairs, and I was afraid to tell my parents. And I told my mother the next day, because my parents had already gone to bed. And so, you know, even when she was in her late 80s and 90s, she would turn it around and put the blame back on me somehow. And too often that's what happens. You know, because parents are not necessarily always adults, no matter how old they are. And they take umbrage as if you're blaming them and they can't handle the guilt. And so they turn it around and make it somehow your fault. And, you know, I have to say, I did the same thing to my youngest daughter one time. She was taking tennis lessons, and the tennis instructor was this old man. We jokingly called him Eager Ed. And she told me one day that he had put his arms, he was putting his arms around her to show her how to hold the racket. Well, that is something that a tennis instructor does so that he can move the arm out and show you the proper stance and how. And she felt that he was holding her too close, and it made her uncomfortable. And I had not yet dealt with my own stuff, and I still was very fearful about confronting men on their issues, because my experience with that was that I would wind up getting hit. So what I did, and I'm ashamed to say it, but it is what I did, and I have to own it, I told her that she needed to confront him and tell him, don't do that. That makes me uncomfortable. Now, I should have gone down there with her and stood by her and let her tell him and told, you know, but I didn't. And to this day, I feel guilty about it. And we talk about it, she and I. She's a mother of four now. She's going to be 45 the end of May. So it's a long time since. But, you know, when you're also a victim of abuse and you haven't dealt with the fear of retribution yet, you know, you don't always make the right choices with your own children. So, you know, finding my voice at whatever it was, however old I was 10 years ago, well, I'm 81 now, so I was 71. You know, that was life-shattering, life-changing for me to be able to speak about it and not get hit or dismissed or invalidated, because that had been my previous experience. You know, I was crazy. I was overreacting. I was too emotional. Whatever I would say to try to address it with my parents or, you know, anybody that I felt I could talk to, I would be undercut. So what is the reaction that most people have if they're not being validated, if they're not being listened to? They shut down and they feel powerless, which builds the frustration and the anger and the pain to an even higher level. It's like a boiler, you know, it's like the steam is building up, building up, building up, and then all of a sudden it blows, and then you have all of these other outrageous reactions to things. You lose your temper easily, you walk away in a fit, you know, all the behaviors that are not healthy and not pragmatic and not proactive. So once I started speaking out, I didn't speak out about everything initially, but over time, because I had a group of sisters who were also survivors, and of course, most of us had the same rapist, so we were able to support each other and validate each other's experience. But there were other things that started surfacing in my life from my past that I was beginning to have to face, having to address, that I was beginning to reveal to the sisters bit by bit. And their reactions caused me to get upset and cry and get angry and storm off, and, you know, because I couldn't handle it, because it was so tender and so sensitive that just saying the words out loud was almost more than I could bear. And then over time, once it was framed properly by some of the support people, I was able to face it and live with it. But, you know, speaking your truth and finding your voice is not just like a one-moment thing and it just happens and it's over and then you're free. It comes in waves. It comes in increments, little by little, you know, like shedding layers of skin, you know, until you get to the core. And it's painful. Each layer that you shed, but in the end, you feel lighter. When you had been carrying so much weight around that you didn't even realize how light you really could feel. And it's a revelation. It's an absolute revelation. So it's just very delicate. It's very, very delicate.
I love the way that you expressed that. You explained it. It's very painful, and it's like you know, shedding layers of skin. And again, it's very painful, and it really does have to happen little by little. And then that really just takes us to the importance of being patient in our healing journey. And then, like you said, you shared your story when you started sharing your story when you were 71 years old. I'm sorry, I'm hearing the echo a little bit still. But, you know, you started sharing your story at 71, so it's never too late, you know, and understanding that everybody's time frame is different. Everybody's time frame is different. I wanted to say so sorry that you went through that, so many different traumatic experiences. I wanted to also comment on, you know, what you shared as far as, you know, when you told your friend to confront him. And you felt guilty that you didn't confront him with her or support her in the confronting, but you gave her her power. You taught her how to use her voice. You taught her how to fend for herself and how to set healthy boundaries. And that is very difficult when it comes to survivors of sexual abuse. When we've been silenced, we've been told not to tell, keep a secret, or if you tell, you get judged, or some people just make ignorant comments because they just lack of education or empathy or whatever have you. Those things shut us. And so there's times where we have a hard time speaking in public, speaking in front of people. Certain things are very private and intimate and close to us that we don't share with everyone. And some people will look at us or may think like, oh, okay, for example, I have a struggle sometimes praying in front of people. That's something intimate that I've done in my tears privately with God because I've shed so many tears. And so I can have a regular conversation. I could pray for hours, but it's something that I do intimately and I don't do it like how other people do it. And so sometimes there may be some pressure, you know, for me to pray in front of people. And it may also feel uncomfortable and something that I try to work through. I wanted to address, you know, you talked about, I'm going to just take you back for a little minute there when you talked about how this person stuck his tongue in your mouth and you weren't able to talk about it till the next day. How did that little girl feel in the bed just trying to figure out how to tell your parents, how to tell your mom, and with that fear of not being believed or it being flipped back on you or you getting hit or getting in trouble? Can you, like, just talk to us a little bit about that? Do you remember at all a little bit of that feeling?
Well, the man was a friend of my parents, and he was an alcoholic. I look back on it now, and I see that. He was the boyfriend of a lady friend. They were a couple, and they all sang in this chorus together with my parents. And I guess he had an argument with his girlfriend, and he had come to stay with us for the weekend. And I'd known him since I was little. So it was really a shock to me. And I don't remember what happened, but I just remember I took my glass of milk and I ran upstairs to my bedroom and closed the door. And I honestly don't remember what I thought after that or you know, how I reacted. I know I was disgusted. And the next day when I told my mother, she kind of dismissed it, you know, that I overreact. That was always her response to everything. Oh, you're just being overly emotional. You're just overreacting. I'm sure he didn't mean it. Yeah. So the next night, I was very, very careful, made sure he was already locked away in the guest room or in the bathroom, wherever he was, before I went down, because I always used to like to have a glass of milk before I went to sleep. And I made sure he wasn't there, and I went down, tiptoed down, secretly got my little milk, and I quietly tiptoed upstairs, and he was standing in my bathroom, which was also the guest bathroom, and the door was slightly open, and he was standing in front of the wash basin naked. I didn't know what to do. I was afraid to run across the landing into my bedroom because my bedroom was right next door to that bathroom. And to this day, I can't remember what I did, how I dealt with it. Did I run past really quickly, or did I go back downstairs and wait until I heard him go into his bedroom and close the door? I just simply do not remember. But I remember talking about it to my mother when we were both old ladies, you know, and her just kind of blowing me off because she felt guilty that she had not done something or felt guilty that I was accusing her of not doing something. And she was basically covering up her own guilt, you know, or denying her own guilt in the matter. So, you know, it's just so tricky. I mean, there were so many other little things that even when I was 24 and my mother was in the hospital having a hysterectomy and she wanted me to look after Dad, my stepdad, who had raised me from the time I was 3, because my dad was killed in World War II. So, So my stepdad was the only dad I had ever known. And so I was supposed to look after my stepdad and my little sister, make sure they had food and made sure the laundry and blah, 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 and all that. So we were sitting at the breakfast table, and Dad asked me if I had ever thought about sleeping with him. And I was so stunned, I didn't know what to say. And I think I just stuttered around and I said, oh, well, I would never do anything like that to Mom. I don't know why that was my concern instead of saying, how could you possibly ask a question like that of me, your daughter? You know, I turned it and made it about Mom. So I was so upset about it that and disgusted about it. So years later, I mean many, many, many years later, when I was probably in my 50s or even 60s, he had said something to me very rudely in the den, and the three of us had been sitting there watching television in the evening. I guess I'd been over for dinner or something, I don't remember. And I got up and I left, and as I was leaving, my mom came rushing up to me, and I just told her what he had said And I said, well, you just tell your husband, blah, 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 blah. I don't even remember what I said exactly. And so then the next time I was over, he brought it up in the den, and but in a weird way, not even addressing it directly, he just made this comment that in Egypt, in ancient Egypt, you know, pharaohs had children with their daughters, you know, as if that made it okay. And that was sort of the way he dismissed it. And my mother just tightened her lips and you know, looked back down at her. She'd do her hand sewing in the evening. I just, you know, nobody ever talked about it again. That was it.
Wow. That is
I mean, just weird. I mean, weird communication. I mean, how do you have any rational discussion about things like that when people don't even respond in a way that makes any sense? You just feel stymied. And I never talked about it in my book because my cousin, my step-cousin, who's my age, he never really knew my father, and my father was this sort of iconic, old, legendary Disney artist who he adored. And his father dead, and, well, both of our fathers were dead, and we had reconnected after many, many years. Hadn't seen each other, I think, since we were 13. And he had these wonderful memories and thoughts about my dad. And I gave him a photograph of my dad at his drawing table. And he looked down at it, and I saw tears dripping down his cheeks onto the picture. And I couldn't bear to shatter the one memory, the one thing he felt about my father. You know, it's so complicated. There are several things that I didn't write in my book about my father and his father and his other brother, not my cousin's father, but because I didn't want to hurt my cousin. You know, and
well, hopefully the next book will have a little more, little by little, layer by layer.
That's right. You know, maybe so, or maybe it's just not that important, you know, as long as I address it. If we address it and, you know, we have to also not hurt people in the process, even though, I mean, because my cousin's an innocent, you know, and he's dear, and he has to, you know, he has to have something to hold on to. So do you knock the knees out from somebody who needs something to hold on to just to be able to vent your own toxins? You know, it was, when I was writing the book, that was a very, very fine line I was walking. And I just simply couldn't bring myself to hurt him. I had to leave him with some illusion, you know, we're both 81. And if he can hold on to something good about my father, let him. That's my gift to him.
Yep, one step at a time, you know, and you share what you feel comfortable in the platforms that, you know, in the way that you feel comfortable. And I think that that's, you know, that's a beautiful thing. It's just a personal, healing is a personal journey, and you do what feels safe and best for you in your heart. So if that's what's in your heart, then you're following your heart and you're doing exactly what you need to be doing. I wanted to, you know, I wanted you to talk a little bit about some of the background as far as, you know, moving to the next part as far as, you know, 1963 and being a Playboy bunny or Playboy's Miss September. Before we do that, I wanted to open up the lines and see if anyone would like to join or make a comment or anything like that. I'm going to open up the mic. And
Okay. Anyone
who would like to make a comment, feel free to join. So all the mics are open. We have a few people on the panel.
Mm-hmm.
Hello.
Hi. Who's calling?
Hey, Dr. Nancy. Hello, everyone. It's Christina Jones.
Hi.
And, hey,
hello.
I was just listening again, and one of the things that I'm learning about forgiveness is a term called radical acceptance, and it doesn't mean you have to, it's not accepting per se what happened or how it happened or who did what. It's learning how to see it for what it is and then just kind of slowly learn how to live around it. And that was something that I had to, that I'm still learning myself, you know, because just like you were talking about your cousin and how they viewed your dad, your stepfather, and they didn't see him in the way that you seen them because of what you experienced that, you know, but, and that was something similar with me and my situation. And I am able to see this person in a different light who violated me at such a young age. And that person being who they are to other people, and also understanding for, in my case, it's a bit different because this person at the time was on drugs really bad, you know, and it's not excusing what they did, but it's me learning how to cope and move forward in my life and to invite that person back into my life because it happened over 30 years ago. And I know that everyone isn't at that stage in their life, but that's my encouragement is just, you know, thank you for your bravery of sharing that with us all tonight.
You're welcome.
And my encouragement is just like, you know, just your voice is power and your voice is healing, you know, and we deserve that for ourselves. And I think part of radical acceptance is that healing piece of it. So yeah.
Well, yeah, you're right, you know. And I think, you know, part of the complexity of the situation is, you know, I still loved my stepdad. You know, when he died in 1993, he was 83, 2 years older than I am now. And I wailed like a baby. And I still miss him. How do you make up, you know, how do you put it all together, you know? And I think this is such a difficult thing for people when we've been abused. I mean, he never raped me or anything like that, but just the fact that he would ask something like that, and I was 24. I mean, there were other little things, and his father, when I was 8 years old, had touched me between the legs briefly, but it was enough to get my attention. His younger brother seduced me when I was 18 also. So there were all of these things that had happened over a period of time and, you know, that I just didn't put in my book. I just couldn't because of my cousin Paul, because I just couldn't knock the foundation out from under him, you know? It's just so complex. And so these people that have brought abuse into your life, you still have love for them. And how do you reconcile that? You know, and so I think what you're talking about, radical acceptance, is so, so much that, you know. I mean, you really have to, you have to try to understand where they were coming from at the time, what their background was, their vision of the world, their perceptions, and the culture of the time as well. I mean, things have certainly changed over the last 30 years. I can guarantee you that. And me being 81, I mean, I have seen the arc of social change, you know, from being a World War II baby and going all through the 50s and you know, the Civil Rights Act and you know, I mean, going from a time of, you know, television shows, Father Knows Best, to the Beatles, to, you know, Joe Cocker, to Woodstock, to, you know, Martin Luther King being assassinated, to JFK, all of those really, really heavy-duty political and social happenings. I mean, that was a radical time. And everybody's head was flipping back and forth. And so while all of that was going on, we were also dealing with our own personal stuff, going from the 1950s where, you know, you had to sit with your ankles crossed and, you know, hands folded neatly in your lap and be a lady and not say heck or darn. And then all of a sudden, the favorite adjective is the F-bomb. And then suddenly Playboy, and you're taking your clothes off, and it becomes acceptable to sleep with people without being married to them. And, you know, I mean, it just changed the whole social landscape. So we were dealing with personal changes and personal traumas at the same time as the world was going through all of these other big changes. And how does a young girl figure it out on her own if she doesn't have a mentor, somebody she can trust? And if she thinks she trusts somebody and they turn out to be one more person who shines their apple but doesn't stand strong and true and full of integrity, and, you know, how do you know what way to go? You know, you have been taught that there's this one person, you know, that's supposed to be the love of your life, you know, the old 1940s, 1950s romantic story, you know, the prince will come along, all of that fairy tale stuff that we were all kind of raised on through the movies and stuff, only to discover that just wasn't true. And in the end, we had to become our own heroes. And we had to trust in ourselves and in our judgment. And we couldn't expect anybody else to tell us what was right. We had to stop and get away from the noise and all the voices and everybody's point of view and try to find our own point of view. Well, not everybody can lift themselves up out of the situation and get away. And so you're still there sitting in the middle of the chaos trying to figure it out. And it's a miracle that anybody does. But God bless every one of you and every one of us who has somehow, you know. I always think of that wonderful song, Amazing Grace, you know. How sweet the sound, saved a poor wretch like me, you know.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful song, and so touching when you really think about it, how we were saved by grace.
Saved by grace.
I wanted to make sure, saved by grace, only that. I wanted just to make sure that you do get a chance to speak a little bit about your story, about, you know, being kidnapped and being, you know, sex trafficked and some of what you've been through, because I think especially with the temperature, the time, some of the stuff that we're dealing with right now, how victims are really starting to talk about it, you know, what sex trafficking really is. Some people think this is sex trafficking when this is also sex trafficking. So if you could share a little bit of that story, that would be great.
Wow. Okay. Well, it's a complicated story, but because when I was at school in New York in 1960-61, I was raped 3 times. I was away from home, and trusting and young and naive, I didn't even know how to go to the supermarket, you know, because I'd come from Connecticut and lived out of town in the woods, and my mom and dad did everything, and so I was bouncing off of that, and they didn't know what had happened to me. All they knew was that I had boyfriends, and they knew I was no longer a virgin, and I was ditching school a lot. They didn't know that I was ditching school because I was bouncing off of the trauma of being raped, and I was flirting with razor blades. So they just thought I was being a bad girl, and they yanked me home to Connecticut, where I promptly got ill for 2 weeks, and they put me on a plane and sent me off to my grandma's in West Hollywood. They somehow had this idea that living with my grandmother, who was paralyzed on her right side from 4 years old from polio, that she was better able to cope with me, if you can imagine that. So, and her sister, who was a school teacher all of her life and never married. So I was sent to them. And, of course, there were all the judgments, and it was just, it was awful. And so I ran away and wound up bouncing around, and I guess I was targeted by this one guy, Afro-Cuban drummer. He was being guided by a black folk singer, a guy named Don Galloway, who came back to our apartment with my then roommate, who was a dulcimer player. And so his name was Louis, and he kept coming back. And what I didn't know, of course, was that he was essentially a con man. And he had seen some of my clothes from back east and my this and that. And I must have shared with him that when I turned 21, I was going to be getting the savings bonds, the war savings bonds from my first father. So he pretty much took over my life. And in that period of time, he and this other guy who was a photographer, they decided that they would take some pictures because they were trying to promote their own careers. And pretty soon the pictures became semi-nude. And then they started submitting them to different magazines. And the whole time I thought I was doing them a favor by helping their careers as photographers. And I had never heard of Playboy magazine. I'd never seen a pinup magazine in my life, and I didn't know that Playboy was a big deal or anything. All I thought was, oh God, I hope nobody ever sees this. I hope my dad doesn't see this. He'll kill me. So anyway, of course, they did see it, and I was disowned, and pretty much at the mercy of this man who became the father of my son, and we got married in Mexico, which I didn't know was illegal in this country unless you registered it here, but he did, and he knew that I was used to turning everything over to my husband, the money, because that's the way I was raised. My mother would always say, honey, you don't need to worry about arithmetic. Your husband will take care of all of that. Yeah, that's the way I was raised. And I think most women in those days were. So, so of course, I signed everything over to him, and I wound up becoming a Playboy centerfold without realizing that that was a big deal or that anyone would ever recognize me. I signed the check over to him because he was the photographer, and I signed over all of my war savings bonds from my dad when I got them, and had my son, and he brought his two children, who were toddlers, from his previous relationship, and the two children were 3 and 4, I think, at that time. And so for 2 years, I was their mom, and he beat me and beat me and beat me and started forcing me to go out on appointments, hooked me up with some woman who was a madam, and she had all these high-end clients, movie stars and political people. And so for 3 horrible months, I had to turn 5 tricks a day, 7 days a week, and get beaten. And he starved me, and I wound up giving birth to my son at 116 pounds, if you can imagine, being full-term pregnant at 116 pounds. And the baby was 5 pounds and 8 ounces. And he was supposed to be adopted out because Louis didn't want me to keep him. But then I realized he was basically also selling my baby. And then the adoptive parents didn't want him because he was too dark. So for a while, every time he would put us someplace, he would go out for cigarettes and then not come back, weeks at a time. So the children and I were kicked out of this place and that place, and we were pushing the stroller and the babies and out in Venice Beach on the boardwalk and panhandling and trying to find places to shelter. And you know, it was a rough time. And then he somehow appeared periodically, always seemed to know where we were. I don't know if he had somebody watching us. But anyway, in the meantime, I lost everything I had ever owned, every penny. And I finally, after it all, I just couldn't take anymore. And I was so sick, I tried to escape. And he caught me and beat me for hours and broke my front tooth. And I have a lot of arthritis in my neck from being beaten and having my head banged into door jams and karate chopped across the throat and all this stuff. So I was 21. I guess I was 21. Yeah. Or 22 maybe. I always get confused because my birthday is December, so it's always at the end of whatever year. Have to do the math, you know. So at some point when I came to the next day, I somehow managed to sneak a call into my mother, God knows, but I had found out that they had moved out to California, and my dad had gone back to the animation studios to work. And she said that she and Daddy were going to come up and get me. But she wasn't going to take his children and really didn't want my baby. So I had to figure it out. And what she did I told her no, because I was also frightened for my father because he was, you know, the Sicilian, you know, tyrant patriarch, you know. And I was afraid that he would get hurt because he was older. He was 10 years older than my mom. And gray-haired. He was gray-haired when we met him, you know, in 1946. He was already gray. And so I said, no, I would work it out, that I had it all figured out. Of course, I was lying through my broken teeth. And So ultimately she sent the police up the next day, and they came in and somebody had a marijuana joint in his pocket, and it was a felony, and they busted the whole house, took all my children away from me. And I was in the worst women's prison in the country for 12 hours until I got bailed out. And he expected me to go and bail him out by turning tricks again. And I told the bail bondsman no. So he wound up having to stay in jail for 4 months. And that gave me time to get away. And I had, if my son was in the foster home for a year, and when I was allowed to go up and get him again, because in that year I wound up working at the Playboy Club. They opened the club on the Strip in New Year's Eve 64. And because I had been a playmate, I was able to get the job. And we were making good money. And I was able to show the social workers that I had a regular paycheck and I wasn't hooking and doing all these things, you know. So, and then he got out and he found out where I was and tried to attack me, brought a couple of thugs. And the interesting thing was that my neighbor was Frank Sinatra's valet, George Jacobs. He's written a book called Mr. S about his years with Sinatra. And he used to have parties next door for the bunnies, and he knew my story. And I had my ex and his two thugs had pushed themselves into my apartment, and they were getting ready to beat me and kill me. And George just happened to call at that moment. And I grabbed the phone really fast, and he said, "Are you all right?" Because he heard in my voice. And I just said, "No." And he said, "Do you want me to call the cops?" I said, "Absolutely." And in 2 minutes, they were there at the door. And they ushered them out, and I wound up moving to another part of town. But, you know, it was just an ongoing thing. And so, you know, 3 months, in the total scheme of things, it doesn't seem like it's a long time, but it was torture. And it spoiled my view of life. All of the big movie stars that had been my clients, I saw them in a different light. And my desire to be an actress anymore, you know, even though that was all I knew how to do to make a living, except cocktail waitressing, you know, I didn't want to be an actress anymore, really, because I saw the people that I might have to see if I was working on a film. And I lost my respect because I knew what they did behind the scenes. I knew how much they paid, and I knew who they really were behind the characters they played. And it just destroyed my love of the career that I had chosen, you know, initially. So it took years. You know, I was sick. I had to have my teeth done, and, you know, I came away with it with venereal diseases and abscesses in my groin, and then I had to get the baby back after a year, and then my stepchildren had to stay. And they, you know, the cruelty of having to go pick up my baby and my little daughter running after me, screaming, "Mama, Mama, why are you taking the baby and not taking me?" And how do you explain that to a 4.5-year-old? You know, how do you explain that? You know, I'd had her since before she knew that she wasn't really mine. You know, I mean, there was trauma upon trauma upon trauma. And it took years of me just bouncing off of all of that to try to find a way to deal with myself, my child. And I started writing songs. You know, it was the 60s, and I had learned a few chords on the guitar. And I started putting my feelings into song. And then, of course, Vietnam was happening, so we were singing anti-war songs, and I could funnel a lot of my anger and my hurt and my passion into anti-war songs. And then, you know, Black Power, and we had all of that coming along, and the Love-Ins, and, you know, Love and Peace and the Summer of Love and Rock and Roll. And, you know, I mean, there were so many drastic changes socially in that little block of time between 64 and 69 that I was caught up in it all, dealing with my own personal stuff, but also involving myself, you know, marching in the streets with my son on my shoulders and raising money for Bobby Seale's defense for the Black Panthers. And, you know, I mean, we were just involved, and I was able to redirect all of that pain, personal pain, into something outside myself. But that didn't mean it was gone, because I still hadn't addressed my own stuff, you know? But, you know, over time, little bit by little bit, but then miraculously, I was offered a recording contract with Capitol Records, which was like a gift from God. And the music attorney, had negotiated my contract and was giving a party to successfully to celebrate the signing of the contract. And my son drowned in his swimming pool at the beginning of the party. And my life was over. I mean, that was it. That was the end. I didn't want to live anymore. And I couldn't sing. I couldn't, you know, I'd go into the studio even. And I just, you know, my heart was gone. My music was gone. And and then Cosby, I was supposed to have an audition with him because I needed some money to eat. And I was an actress. I was a Screen Actors Guild actress. So, you know, my girlfriend, Francesca, she was one of the original. Hello?
Can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Oh, yes, I heard a voice come, and I thought maybe I had accidentally muted.
No. Sorry about that. I pressed the button. I was trying to make sure it was silent in the background, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, she got me an audition with Cosby, and he met me in his trailer, and she handed me the 8x10 headshot of my little boy. He had just gotten a commercial to do a McDonald's commercial, and he was also a Screen Actors Guild member. He had done a Wonder Bread commercial earlier that year. And we were so excited, you know, that weekend, all of these good things happening to both of us. And anyway, taking that photo to Cosby, I think, is what saved me from getting raped in his trailer at that time, because recently I've heard that he assaulted a 14-year-old girl in his trailer. But I handed him my son's picture, and it's a beautiful picture where he's just looking directly into the lens. And Cosby just sat down and held the picture and just looked at it and looked at it, and he could hardly even talk to me. He just couldn't say a word. He was just hypnotized by my son. And and I just started telling him what had happened, and I just was blah, 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 you know, and he just never responded, and I got so uncomfortable, and I figured I'd blown any possibility of me getting work, so I just stood up really quick and excused myself and took the picture and said thank you, and I left. And I think that's what saved me that day. But a while later, I was having, 4 o'clock at the Cafe Figaro which is a little cafe on the edge of West Hollywood in Beverly Hills, with my roommate. And she had these kind of white blue eyes that, and it turns out he has a fetish for certain eyes. And hers were unforgettable. And he already knew my story, and I was crying in my soup. I just had a horrible day. You know, if you lose a child, it's like a horse kicking you in the gut all the time. You can't ever, you know, I mean, to this day, I have meltdowns, you know, just little things that will trigger, and I just fall apart. And there's just nothing you can do about it. You know, you lose a child, you're losing you. You're losing everything. And so he came up to the table and he saw me crying and he said to her, you know, that he thought it would be good for me to go and get a massage and go to the spa. And so he gave her some money and his telephone number, his private line on a little scrap of paper, and said, go take her down to the spa and have her, you know, get a massage and go to the spa, and then when you get back to your house, call me and I'll send my driver over and I'll pick you up and take you out to dinner. I think it'll be good for Vicky. Well, we did that, and I really didn't care, honestly. I would have been really happy if he'd just comped us for another carafe of wine, but, you know, as it turned out, we did do that. We went to the restaurant, and they were chatting each other up. You know, he was trying to entertain her, but he kept trying to get us to laugh and everything, and I was not in that mood at all. And so finally he reached over and he put a pill next to my glass, and he said, here, take this. It'll make you feel better. It'll make us all feel better. And he really guilted me, you know, and I think I just felt obligated because he'd been so nice to us, you know, and so he did the same thing to her, and then he pretended to take a pill, and then he reached over and stuck another one directly in my mouth and right in her mouth as well, and pretty soon our faces were practically in our plates, and I said, I want to go home, because I was feeling sick to my stomach. And he said, oh, sure, no problem. Walked us up to the parking lot, and his chauffeur was gone. And I said, well, where's your chauffeur? And he said, oh, he had something else to do. And I remember thinking, even in my drugged-out state, that funny that your chauffeur isn't doing what you want him to do, not what he wanted to do. And he said, but no problem, I'll drive you home. And my grandma's house was, oh, I don't know, 5 minutes from the restaurant. It was, you know, right there in West Hollywood near the Strip. And instead of going down onto the Strip, he went up into the Hollywood Hills, winding around, and I was sitting in the back, and my roommate was sitting in the front. And we were both just, you know, rolling around, and I don't know about her, but I was trying to keep from throwing up in this big star's car. And then all of a sudden he stopped, and there was a building. He said, oh, there's my office. I just want to take you upstairs and show you my awards. And I was thinking, oh, man, that's the last thing I want to do. And maybe I'll just sit here and let them go because they're the ones who seem to have the energy between them. I'll wait. But he got her out, and then he reached in the back seat and took me out and went up to in this little elevator to the second floor. And it turned out it wasn't an office at all. It was just a little place, had a little, you know, writing desk and a fake French provincial phone and two little love seats. But it did have posters of him and Robert Culp and I Spy framed on the wall and little awards on the wall. And she went over to one and sat down and passed out. And I sat down on the other one and put my head back and just tried to keep from throwing up and tried to control the spinners. And then everything got really silent, and that kind of shook me awake. And I looked around thinking they had left me or gone in the other room or something. I didn't know what. And he was sitting right next to her, and she was completely unconscious. And I could, you know, the way he was looking and, you know, leaning over her, I could see that, you know, what his intention was, and I tried to distract him, and he ignored me, and then he started looking irritated, and then he started really getting irritated looking, and then finally he just stood up and walked towards me, and I got scared because I thought I was going to get hit, and having had that experience with my son's father, I stood up, and then my legs were like rubber. Next thing I knew, I was on my knees, and he was sitting down unzipping his fly, and anyway, it all happened, and then he decided he was going to walk out, so he finished and started to slam out at the little place, and I said, well, how are we going to get home? And I could hardly talk. I was, my thoughts weren't connecting to my tongue, and he just didn't even look at me. He pointed to the phone, and he just said, call a cab, and he slammed the door and walked out. And I just staggered over to her and shook her awake, and I said, we've got to get out of here. We've got to get out of here. And then how are we going to call a cab? We don't know where we are. And then we thought, well, maybe if we call home to her boyfriend, maybe he can figure something out because our brains weren't working. And we went over to the phone, and there was no dial tone. So she said it must have come out of the jack, and got down on her hands and knees and crawled under the desk, and there was no jack. It was a prop phone. The cord was one of those old cloth cords, and it was cut. So then we knew we had been duped, and it had been planned and the whole time, and so we staggered out of there. We thought the only thing we can do is go out on the sidewalk and see where we are and try to figure it out from there. And it was probably, I don't know, maybe 10:30 or so at night by then. I guess it was dark. It wasn't dark when we got there, but it was dark when we left. And we were up in the Hollywood Hills, and we could see all the lights down below. And she started running, and I started running after her. And she got out on the strip, and there was a taxi passing by, and she grabbed it. And we got home, and we ran into the house, and her boyfriend was waiting, and she flew into his arms, and he put his arms around her, and they went off to their bedroom, and I went off into the back bedroom. We were living at my grandma's house by then because she died 3 weeks after my son. So I had moved from my girlfriend's into my grandma's house and needed roommates, and that's how we wound up there. And it was weird because I was in the same bedroom being suicidal, trying to slash my wrists after that. And it was the same bedroom that I had been in a crib when I was a baby. Such a weird circle, you know. So anyway, after that, I just left Los Angeles. I walked away from the contract. I couldn't do anything. And I wound up for almost a year living in a dirt-floored garage out in a canyon, 45-minute Topanga Canyon, and put rugs on the dirt and India prints hanging on the concrete walls. And I had been sewing this little crazy quilt for my son's bed when he died. And so during the day, I would sew that, and I'd sleep under it at night. And I just became, you know, I was just a crazy girl, you know. Really, it was just the last thing, you know, last straw. Nobody knew what to do with me. You know, crisis therapy, nobody knew anything. And then my boyfriend came home, saw me trying to slash my wrist, slapped me in the face, threw me on the bed and raped me, threw stuff in his duffel bag and left. So, I mean, it was just one horrible thing after another, you know, trying to get up off of the earlier trauma in my life and then getting crunched again. It was just beyond imaginable. But the reason I left and wound up where I did was that something came to me. I just knew that I was going to die if I stayed where I was. I just knew. And tried to go back to remembering who I was before all of the trauma happened. You know, who was I before I just got battered around and starved and pimped and stolen from and had everything I owned that spoke of my childhood stripped from me, you know, of my identity, my family, everything. And I thought the only thing I could remember was the only time I really remembered being me was when I was a little girl playing alone in the woods of Connecticut with my cat, my trusty cat. And I thought, that's what I have to do. I have to get back to nature to find myself. I have to surgically excise myself from this location, from this situation, from these people, from this environment. Otherwise, I will die. And so that's what I did, and it saved me.
Thank you for sharing. That was just such a powerful testimony, you know, just hearing about the trauma that you had to go through and how you had to just keep surviving trauma back to back to back to back to back. I want you to, and just because of the sake of time, I wish we had more time because I would kind of dig a little deeper into that. But can you tell us how you got to where you are today? Like you said, you saw that if you kept going in that direction, you were not going to survive. And this felt good to you. What brought you into the new path of going into hospice and now focusing on your self-care and, you know, advocacy? What brought you here today?
Well, I went on a 13-year walkabout. Once I was out of Los Angeles, away from show business, even though I had to go into town every once in a while, do a couple of days' work on a crappy movie just so that I could eat and feed my dog and, you know, have gas for the car, I still was out of it, and I was in nature, and I met this Cajun guy, singer-songwriter, guitar picker, and his father in Louisiana, he had had a stroke, and he wanted to go back to Louisiana to be with his father. And he said, well, exactly the words he said was, "Vicky Blue, I love you. I'm leaving for New Orleans in 10 minutes. You coming with me?" And at that point, I thought, nothing left to lose. So I just did. Had no idea what I was looking for. I just knew I somebody said they loved me. That was enough, you know, and they were going to take me home to their mom and dad, you know. I just wanted to get the hell out, and that was the way to do it. And he wrote beautiful songs, and he was an excellent guitarist, and he had a wonderful dog. And I'm a sucker for animals, as you might have guessed. Have two of them on my feet right now. And so we hit the road, and his mother was my saint. She truly was my savior. When we got there, she was a very simple Cajun woman, cooked for the school cafeteria all of her life. She had had a husband who had been a womanizer and a drinker, and though she never said exactly, I wouldn't have been surprised that he hadn't abused her, but he had died, and she was married again to another man who was a carpenter, who was a fisherman, and just the dearest, dearest people in the whole world. And she taught me how to make a real good country Cajun gumbo, taught me how to put up things for winter, taught me how to wring a chicken's neck and defeather it and get it in the pot in 15 minutes. She and I would sit and chop okra. We would shell crawfish. We would do all year long. We would sit at her kitchen counter, and she'd have her little beer and her cigarette, and we would be chopping. Then all of a sudden she'd stop and she'd look at me, and her eyes would fill up with tears, and she'd say, "I love you, Sha. I love you." And do you know, it hit me that I had never heard my mother ever speak to me like that, ever. ever just spontaneously look at me with tears in her eyes and say how much she loved me. And just recently I was sorting out some drawers and I found some letters that she had sent to me before she died. And they were so full of love, I sat here and cried like a baby. This was, you know, last month. And I packed them up and sent them to my daughter, my Cajun daughter, because in case I died, I wanted her to be sure and have them and feel the love.
Wow, that was
nothing like it. Unconditional love, you know. So I crocheted, which was meditative. I cooked gumbo. I had six nieces and my own little girl to sing songs to. And I had my mother-in-law's unconditional love, and it saved my life. Saved my life. So sometimes you just have to follow your own yellow brick road. Go where the love is, even if you don't know that you're going to find it there. Sometimes following your intuition or your instinct or a hand that's reached out to you through the dark, you just have to grab onto it, you know, and pray that God is with you and pray that you're being guided in the right direction. And that's where faith and amazing grace comes in. And it took me home to myself again. I found myself through the unconditional love of this man's family. He's dead now. He was murdered 27 wow. years ago on his way out from Louisiana to see our first grandchild, our grandson, for the first time. Yeah. So, you know, no matter what you do, you turn this way, you turn that way, and trauma follows you, and you just don't know why. But I think maybe because I had something I had to teach. And maybe God thought I was strong enough to handle it and to be able to transform it into love and compassion and empathy and some lessons for other people who needed maybe what my mom gave me, that unconditional love and acceptance and forgiveness not of anything that I did wrong, but that unforgiveness of myself to myself, you know? I think forgiving ourselves is the hardest part. Mm-hmm. And then we have to remind ourselves that we were doing the best we could under the circumstances with the tools we had to work with at the time. And we just can't keep kicking ourselves down the road over it. You know, we have lessons that we have learned from that experience to bring compassion and empathy to others in the world who need it. And if we look at it that way, then we can live through what we've lived through already. You know, we can take it and make it a gift for someone else. We can pass it on and be that hand in the dark to somebody else. You know. So.
And that's so important to hear, especially for survivors, because, again, sometimes we feel alone. We don't feel like there's anybody else around us who we can trust, who we can talk to, who could understand us, but we are able to relate and help support the next person to be able to extend that olive branch. I think it's a beautiful thing. We're down to 5 minutes, Ms. Valentino. I want to make sure that you get a chance to, you know, close out with a few words and also let people know how they can find you, and that would be great.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm on Facebook, And I'm on Instagram and LinkedIn and all of those places, mostly on Facebook. I think it's Victoria Valentino 1 is my handle, I think. I never remember those things because I've got the app. But victoriavalentino.com, and you can go to my page, my contact page, and get through to me that way as well. And all I can say is that through service we are healed. And if we take our own pain and transform it into service for others, we will have fulfilled what we're put here to do by God.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So if anyone else would like to make a comment tonight, I know we have a few people listening. We have a couple of minutes. If anybody would like to say some words to Ms. Valentino, please join us. I'm going to open up the mic, and you're welcome to join. We have three and a half minutes.
Hey, Victoria, this is Kim, and I just want to say thank you for sharing so deeply. You shared a lot, and I know that can't be easy, and you've had a busy week, so I hope that you get to rest some, but thank you for all that you do and for just being a good friend. I mean, you really are a really good friend.
Thank you, Kim, and you are too, and so are you, Dr. Nancy, and I so appreciate both of you, and buy my book. Dirty Diamonds, Purpose Life of a Playboy Icon and Cosby Survivor. You can find it on Amazon and Ingram Spark. And I'm really proud of it. It was painful, but I think it's touching people's lives. And it's a tribute. And I'm doing a one-act play, a tribute to my sister survivors. And it's called Shiro, and we're going to be presenting it in Hollywood on the 21st of July. And we'll be promoting it on Facebook pretty soon, too, once we have our ducks in a row. And we'd love to have you all be with us.
Definitely, definitely. Can you just say the name of the book one more time, Ms. Victoria?
Dirty Diamonds, The Repurposed Life of a Playboy Icon and Cosby Survivor. Dirty Diamonds is my metaphor for life. We're given these beautiful gifts, but they get dirty if we don't take good care of them, and that speaks to the self-care that we need to do for our souls and our bodies.
Thank you, thank you. Well, again, thank you for joining us tonight. Thank you for sharing your story, your testimony with us. We appreciate you, and we wish you continuous luck and blessings. Everyone, thank you for tuning in tonight. We really enjoyed ourselves with Victoria's testimony and being able to learn about our recovery and different steps that we can take towards our recovery and to remember that we're not alone in this healing journey. So, again, thank you, Victoria, for sharing, and everyone else, have a good night. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Good night.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was